Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme...
Hundreds of thousands of survivors of Hurricane Matthew that devastated the Caribbean country of Haiti 3 months ago now face starvation if the international community doesn't move quickly to provide immediate aid. That is the stark warning from Oxfam, who are warning over 800,000 Haitians may be left without food unless efforts are stepped up.
The UK's ambassador to the EU, Sir Ivan Rogers, has resigned, leading to calls that the country's Brexit plans are in turmoil. We'll be bringing you comment and reaction this hour.
A report by Human Rights Watch has accused leading Israeli officials of encouraging soldiers and police officers to kill Palestinians suspected of attacks. However, the findings come as an Israeli military court today convicted a soldier of manslaughter after being videoed shooting dead an unarmed man.
In the final days of 2016, the embattled administration of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela released more so-called political prisoners. But with his opponents claiming another 100 still incarcerated, what impact will this latest round of releases have on the country's bitterly divided politics?
Two UN observers charged with overseeing the peace process in Colombia have landed themselves in trouble after New Year's Eve footage emerged of them dancing with alleged female guerrilla fighters in one of the FARC rebel camps whose disengagement they've been watching over. And when is the best time to stage a $6 million jewellery heist? Midnight on January the 1st, of course. Find out why at the end of the programme.
That's all coming up over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. For years, the Caribbean country of Haiti has been blighted by corruption, earthquakes and hurricanes. The consequences of that has devastated the country's infrastructure, discouraged international investment and led to a brain drain among Haiti's more skilled and better educated population.
But now, humanitarian aid agency Oxfam is warning that unless donor countries commit to promises they made as part of a multi-million dollar UN aid package, hundreds of thousands of Haitians could face starvation as the country's crops look set to fail. And as our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out, the impending food crisis may have even more serious consequences than the destructive earthquake that hit Haiti 6 years ago.
Exactly 3 months ago, Hurricane Matthew slammed into the Caribbean Republic of Haiti, claiming over 3,000 lives. It was the worst storm to hit the region since 1964 and devastated the already fragile infrastructure in a country with among the highest levels of poverty in the Americas. But 3 months on, Oxfam is now warning of a new impending catastrophe that could potentially see almost a million Haitians starve. A projected poor harvest in January and February is predicted to wipe out 80% of the country's crops, a food source that most Haitians rely on to feed themselves. An almost year-long political crisis has added to the despair of the population. But can newly confirmed President Jovenel Moïse be able to reassure international donors and persuade them to fulfil their multi-million dollar pledges and avert a serious humanitarian disaster?
Well, we're now joined in the studio by Eve Hayes-Dicalaf, Programmes Coordinator with the Edinburgh-based Haiti Support Group and an expert on international relations in the region. Eve, welcome to World in Focus. Humanitarian crises such as the one we're now facing in Haiti are sadly not a new experience for the people there. It's 6 years since the country was devastated by a magnitude 7 earthquake that claimed over 100,000 lives. Could we be looking at a much higher death toll from this impending mass food shortage that Oxfam are warning about? And what more could the international community be doing to respond to that?
Well, the international community and its relationship to Haiti has been something that is very problematic. Haiti's been referred to as the nation of NGOs, basically because of the amount of international NGO involvement in the country and the amount of money that goes in and out of Haiti. So Haiti was, until 30 years ago, self-sustaining. So it's an agricultural country where people fed and lived off the land. And actually, you could say that it's the involvement of the international community, as you put it, not a term that I like to use, has devastated Haiti's agriculture. And then this has a knock-on effect. So the Haiti earthquake in January 2010, the death toll was so high because of the amount of people that were living on top of each other in shanty towns because they had moved from the countryside into the bigger cities looking for work, because they couldn't sustain themselves through agriculture. So I think that when we... I think that there's a need to kind of change the discourse on Haiti and think about how we look at Haiti and this idea that somehow international involvement in Haiti is something that is overly positive, because historically it's been very clear that actually this has been something that has been very detrimental to the Haitian people, to the Haitian economy, and also to the environment.
And can you describe what the conditions are like for ordinary Haitians at the moment, especially in the south of the country? That seemed to take the brunt of the hurricane, didn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely devastating. I mean, in the town of Lecaille, for example, practically the whole town was grounded, was floored by Hurricane Matthew. And then you've got problems, obviously, with transport links between places to actually get to the south. So it's been absolutely devastating. Crops have been ruined. It's a very difficult situation that they're facing at this moment.
And Oxfam have today issued this very stark warning that unless the international community and donor countries begin to deliver on their pledges of support for Haiti in the wake of Hurricane Matthew, then we're looking at a very serious humanitarian catastrophe. Can you understand why some international donor countries might feel reluctant to provide funding and support given Haiti's poor record of corruption and political instability?
I think we should turn that on its head and say, let's look at how international donor involvement in Haiti has actually exacerbated and contributed the problems that the country is currently facing. So I think that we're going round in circles, really, in the way that we see the international organisations funding Haiti. A lot of the money that was pledged to Haiti after the earthquake didn't get there. The money that did get there was funded, was given basically to cover the administrative costs of the international NGOs, of vehicles, of offices, of paying their CEOs extremely high wages. So the international involvement, I say again, in Haiti has been disastrous. So what I would say as a member of the Haiti support group, and what we always try and emphasise, is that for Haiti to improve, you need to go to the grassroots, you need to go to community-based organisations, and you need to talk to Haitians, and you need to ask them what they want to improve their quality of life. Because at the moment, the discourse with international NGOs has very much taken local Haitians out of that equation. So to give one example, meetings held about Haiti on policy post 2010 were often held in French, English or Spanish, where over 90% of Haitians speak Haitian Creole as their mother tongue. So Haitians are quite angry, and I think rightfully so at this point in time, because what they see is their relationship with NGOs is very fraught. So it's not something that is seen as, you know, help and aid coming from outside to benefit the country. They see it as being pretty destructive and pretty problematic for the future of Haiti.
And can you tell us the mood of the people at the moment? I mean, they've faced a series of catastrophes, really. But, I mean, are they fearful of what might happen next?
I think they know what's going to happen next, because I think they've lived it time and time again. So, you know, I think they're very, very sceptical of broken promises. So of seeing that yet another natural disaster that has, you know, had a massive impact on their lives and their families' lives and their future. I think they're very resourceful and very practical, and they know, you know, pretty much now we're living in this post-truth era. I think they know pretty much which promises are going to be kept and which are going to be broken. So, yeah, very disappointing to say there's a very negative times ahead for Haiti and for the Haitian people. But on a positive note, start listening to the Haitian people and what they're saying that they want to do about their country and their future.
Yves Hayes de la Calf, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus today.
Thank you.
Well, on the line now from Haiti is Dominique Fevre-Gillian from Oxfam. Dominique, thanks for joining us. Apart from the destroyed infrastructure resulting from Hurricane Matthew, there are other factors that have led to this crisis. Can you explain what they are?
Yes. So what is important to know is that before Matthew, there was actually a severe drought that was brought by El Nino, and that was already causing the decapitalization of the rural population. So as crops were being destroyed by the heat. Matthew also struck at that moment where farmers were getting ready to harvest the little that they already managed to produce. So this situation was compounded by the hurricane, which created a long-term crisis. The storm wiped out 80% of the crops, drowned most of the livestock, and destroyed critical infrastructures.
And Oxfam have been working in Haiti since 1978, but can you tell us what areas you're concentrating on now and describe some of the practical challenges you face in delivering aid and support to those who need it?
Well, our teams were deployed promptly in the most impacted zones of the country. So we're talking mainly the southern peninsula of the country. The humanitarian response required quick action to save lives and prevent outbreak of waterborne diseases. Oxfam's response aims at saving the lives of vulnerable affected people and increase the resilience of 150,000 individuals to face future shocks pretty soon. So the priority will be giving access to water, sanitation, and hygiene, rebuilding people's livelihoods, basic services, infrastructures, increasing protection and of exposed population, gender, and resilience. As a challenge, right after the impact of the hurricane, the roads were inaccessible due to landslides, block roads or fallen bridges in the affected areas. And we've seen, like, progressively efforts grew to increase access to these areas where it was essential to deliver first relief while beginning to assess damages.
And why do you think the international community appears to have turned its back on Haiti? I mean, do you think there is the will there to help Haitians recover from, as you've already alluded to, a series of catastrophes that have struck their country?
Well, we do not think that the international community has turned its back on Haiti. But the truth is, as I explained before, there is probably some sort of a donor's fatigue. Often, unfortunately, hearing about Haiti in the news, we've had a lot of crises here, such as the storm, such as earthquake. So all of that put together just made the international community maybe a little bit tired of hearing about Haiti. Now, that said, at Oxfam, we've seen a lot of solidarity from the world, and we are encouraged by that. And we continue to plead a case for Haiti together with our NGO partners.
And finally, with over 800,000 Haitians facing food insecurity, this is going to take a massive international effort. The initial UN fund was set at a fairly modest $139 million. Would that be enough to meet the needs of those people? And if not, how much funding does the country need to lift it out of this situation?
Well, very good question. The truth is, it is true that at the beginning, it was $139 million that the UN was trying to raise. Now, the flash appeal has been reevaluated to add a close of $200 million, not too far from there. So right now, the UN and the other agencies, they're trying to get to this target, and we are continuing at a time to work with the Haitian government, as well as partners to make long-term development in Haiti.
Dominique Fevrier-Guillain, thanks for speaking to us on World in Focus.
Thank you very much for having me.
The UK's ambassador to the European Union, Sir Ivan Rogers, has resigned. Rogers had been in the post since 2013 and was expected to play a key role in Brexit talks, which are due to start in the next few months, depending on the outcome of court challenges which have plagued the triggering of Article 50. The UK government said Rogers had quit early so a successor could be in place before negotiations start. But last month it was revealed that Rogers had privately told ministers that a UK-EU trade deal might take 10 years to finalise. Our reporter, Liam O'Hare, has more.
Well, in his resignation letter, Rogers called on his colleagues in Brussels to challenge muddled thinking and speak truth to power. He also called on staff to challenge ill-founded arguments and said that serious multilateral negotiating experience is in short supply in Whitehall. The resignation has intensified debate in the UK about just how prepared the government is for the Brexit process. Well, earlier I was joined by the journalist Michael Gray. I asked him if Rogers' resignation was a blessing or a blow to the government.
It's a major blow and a series of punches to the face that the UK government has experienced over the last 6 months. If you think what's happened since the EU referendum vote, there's been a complete stalling of progress on Brexit. They've completely failed to find a negotiating stance in over half a year, and they're fastly now running out of time to do so before Theresa May's self-imposed deadline of March 2017. So Rogers' resignation is obviously someone else jumping off a sinking ship before that negotiation process begins, and that blow is compounded by the manner in which he's resigned, publicly slating the government's lack of negotiating objectives, and in his resignation letter saying serious multilateral negotiation experience is in short supply in Whitehall. So I think all that put together together does show that this is another blow to the Tory government approach to Brexit.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. What does the content of Sir Ivan Rogers' resignation letter tell us about his real feelings about the government and its attitude towards Brexit?
Obviously, he's a diplomat. He was the main chief ambassador for the UK civil service as acting sort of permanent representative to the European Union and the member states within it. So naturally, usually someone who would speak in quite coy, polite, professional language. So it's a 1,400-word statement. By the usual standards of the civil service, is explosive. So I think there's three main points to take from it. The first is that he obviously says there's no government negotiating objectives for the UK, which over 6 months after the decision is incredible, that basically their lead man in Brussels either he isn't aware of those negotiating objectives, he's been cut out of the loop, or they simply don't exist, which would be even worse. He obviously says there's no negotiating experience in Whitehall compared to the EU. He's pointing out that the government's in a weak position for getting a good deal. And third of all, he finishes it with this really weird call to arms for the civil service, telling them to speak truth to power and to confront muddled thinking and ill-founded argument, which is kind of diplomatic language for saying that he doesn't think the Tories are really listening to experts or people that have experience in negotiation, and that they're basically going on ahead despite a lack of evidence and planning.
We've had some response from the government today. Ian Duncan-Smith has said that Ivan Rogers could not be trusted in his position. Do you think it's important, almost imperative, for the government to have a Brexit supporter in post as Britain's ambassador to the EU at this point?
Not really. I think the main priority would be someone with the expertise to do the job. I think Brexit is a national crisis for the British establishment. They've been caught on the hop by the kind of right-wing populism that some of the Tories are trying to ride, and they're not sure how to take the practical step to take Brexit forward without damaging the nation's economic interests or, you know, their friends in the city. They're caught between that right-wing anti-immigrant populism and the financial stability of the country. We saw that with the plunge in the value of sterling. So there's some in the Tories, like Duncan Smith, that would happily just plough along here and a kind of rule Britannia mentality, that they can just change the rules of the game and negotiate a one-sided deal with the other EU 27 nations and get everything that they want. And there's the other side of the Tories, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, who are saying to roll back, to go for a softer approach to Brexit that can secure those economic interests. So I think there's obviously dangers in both approaches, but I think obviously the likes of Ian Duncan-Smith just basically wanting a Brexit with a kind of nonsense Brexit without anyone in charge who knows what they're doing is probably the most dangerous approach.
And just lastly, Michael, Ivan Rogers obviously caused a degree of controversy with his estimation that a trade deal could take up to 10 years and even then might not even be passed by European Parliament as a post-Brexit trade deal between Britain and the other EU states. Do you think that's a fair estimation, or do you think it's possible that in actual fact things could go a lot smoother than he was predicting?
No, I think he was right. I think if you look at what's happened with the transatlantic trade and investment partnership between the EU and the US, if anything, he's been optimistic, saying 10 years. TTIP, of course, is stalled on numerous fronts, and the sort of dozens of chapters that they've tried to negotiate over, I think, 6 or 7 years now, they've agreed zero of the dozens of chapters. Trade negotiations are hugely complicated issues. We saw that with CETA as well being stalled by the Wallonians recently. That was the EU-Canada equivalent. Trade deals are very complicated. They require a lot of delicate compromises, a lot of like long talks and negotiations, and then under the EU rules generally have to be ratified by every single national parliament, and in some cases sub-national parliaments like in Belgium. And so the idea that the Tories can just get everything that they want from a kind of right-wing free trade deal where the UK gets all the free business they want but they don't have to abide by free movement of people, I think, is utterly delusional. And people like Ivan Rogers have essentially been warning about that fact. And if they're ignored, I think Theresa May risks walking the country off a cliff edge.
Well, I'm sure time will tell on that point. But Michael, great to get your thoughts today. Thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Thanks.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, Libyan opposition leader Khalifa Haftar has said that he has been given guarantees by the Russian government that they will call for the arms embargo on Libya to be overturned. We ask what impact this could have on the balance of power on the ground between the UN-backed government of National Accord and the Haftar-led opposition. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4pm in the UK, 11am Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Do you have access to a radio?
Yeah, it's me, Max Kaiser. I'm here with Stacey Herbert. We have a new show on Sputnik called Double Down. It's business, finance, economics, ka-ching, bling, and everything in between. That's Double Down on Sputnik. Tune in!
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from BradBlog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day right here on Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And this is the thing that isn't said often enough. Racism is one of the principal pillars of maintaining white privilege and white power in the United States. It's really that simple. Our institutions were created by white men for white men. And what we have seen over the last 240 years is a steady, slow history of the erosion of that power by white men. Racism is, at its core, it's really about power.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Libyan opposition leader Khalifa Haftar has said that he has been given guarantees by the Russian government that they will call for the arms embargo on Libya to be overturned. We ask what impact this could have on the balance of power on the ground between the UN-backed government of National Accord and the Haftar-led opposition.
A report by Human Rights Watch has accused leading Israeli officials of encouraging soldiers and police officers to kill Palestinians suspected of attacks. However, the findings come as an Israeli military court today convicted a soldier of manslaughter after being videoed shooting dead an unarmed man.
In the final days of 2016, the embattled administration of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela released more so-called political prisoners. But with his opponents claiming another 100 still incarcerated, what impact will this latest round of releases have on the country's bitterly divided politics?
And when is the best time to stage a $6 million jewellery heist? Well, midnight on January 1st, of course. Find out why at the end of this programme.
The Libyan opposition leader General Khalifa Haftar has announced that his supporters in the Russian government will seek to end the UN arms embargo that is in place against his country.
Haftar spoke to the Italian press this week, saying that while the Russian government said it would not send weapons to him while the arms embargo was in place, they will call for it to be overturned at the UN Security Council. For more on this, here's Matthew Ayton.
Libyan opposition General Khalifa Haftar has claimed that Russia is looking to end the arms embargo on his country that has been in place since 2011. The move could see a steady flow of weapons from Russia to the embattled general, whose forces support a rival administration to the UN-backed government. Haftar was asked whether he was promised arms supplies by the Russian government during a recent visit to the country, to which he replied that Moscow told him, quote, "Weapons can only arrive once the UN arms embargo ends." Haftar stressed, however, that he was given assurances that, quote, "Putin will undertake to revoke it." The Government of National Accord, also known as the GNA, which is based in Tripoli, is recognised and supported by most of the international community, including the United Nations. General Haftar, on the other hand, supports an opposing political authority based in Tobruk in the country's east, which currently controls much of Libya's oil production. Western supporters of the GNA have argued that it is a force for stability in the fight against Daesh and attempts to control migration flows out of Libya across the Mediterranean Sea. Other states, such as Russia and Egypt, see Haftar and his Libyan National Army as the foundation of a future military and are sceptical of the GNA's credibility and popularity among the Libyan people. Well, joining me to discuss this further is Mohammed El-Jar from on the ground in Libya, who works with the Atlantic Council as a Libya analyst. So, are claims that Russia is working to lift the embargo on Libya credible, do you think?
I think, following the recent visits by the leader of the House of Representatives, Aguila Saleh, and also by the leader of the Libyan army, the general commander of the Libyan army, Khalifa Haftar, I am sure that they have made their case very clear to the Russian authorities. And I believe that maybe Russia is more willing, possibly, to help the Libyan National Army or its commander, Khalifa Haftar, to deliver a decisive victory in Libya in the future. And if that means that they would fight or help ease the arms embargo on the Libyan National Army, then it might be the case that Russia could help with that. However, I think Russia obviously will have to go through the UN Security Council to do that. And it will not be a straightforward and easy job, because you know that there are Western countries or Western capitals that will not be willing to lift the arms embargo only to support the Libyan National Army by Khalifa Haftar. And the idea within the international community is that the arms embargo should not be lifted unless there is a unity government in Libya that can receive those arms. But with the change in the United States and that Trump is coming into the White House, it is more likely that Russia can play a significant role in the Middle East and in Libya as well.
Why is it that Moscow sees Haftar and the Libyan National Army as more politically credible than the UN-backed GNA, do you think?
The problem with the UN-backed GNA is that it never actually took shape. And it was never clear who was backing that government on the ground. And some of the factions that decided to support the government of National Accord did so out of convenience. There was not any genuine support for this government of National Accord. And the other issue is that this government could not exercise any form of control or influence on the ground. And I think that is the main reason that this government, the UN-backed government, never actually was a credible or reliable partner for Russia, but for others as well. And I think now that the presidential council of the UN-backed government is disintegrating with the resignation of the deputy prime minister, Moussa Al-Kouni, a couple of days ago, and with the infighting that's taking place within the presidential council, it shows that they are not a credible partner on the ground. On the other hand, you have the Libyan National Army consolidating its positions on the ground, exerting influence and control on eastern Libya, parts of the south, and also on western Libya. And most importantly, they were able to take over the oil terminals in the central region of Libya. So all of this makes the Libyan National Army and its leader, Khalifa Haftar, the candidate who can actually deliver on the ground for Russia, but also for regional players such as Egypt as well, or the UAE, the Saudi Arabia, etc. And they see him as potentially a symbol for stability, which seems to be the argument that everyone is going for. Everyone seems to be looking for stability more than anything else. And it seems that the argument that Haftar is giving to the international community and to the Russian leadership as well.
But there are, of course, those who argue that support for Haftar is to violate international consensus, that the GNA is the legitimate governing body of Libya. I mean, are these people living in the past, would you say?
I think the next few days will show that the presidential council has collapsed. And it will show that the Libyan political agreement was never going to work. It was an unworkable agreement. It had some good elements within it, but at the very end, it could not be implemented on the ground. And it has been more than a year now. So you could say that they're talking in the past, and they are stuck in the past in some respect. And the other point is that what will determine the future of events in Libya is what happens on the ground. It's the developments, and currently there is military escalation taking place between the Libyan National Army and forces from the city of Misrata in the central region and also in the southern region of Sabha and Al-Jufra as well. So events from the ground will determine where things go. But currently it seems that the UN, the international community at large, do not have an alternative. And it seems that everyone is now possibly waiting for the developments on the ground to determine who the key players are or who can dominate Libya and take over and provide some sort of stability and rule the country. Or maybe it could be another worst-case scenario of a long-winded civil war between Libyan factions. Because there is a possibility that no one is strong enough to rule Libya yet, but everyone is strong enough to get in the way of those who want to rule Libya.
Well, that ties in nicely with what I wanted to ask you lastly. Just saying that the arms embargo was lifted, how could the Russian arming of Haftar change the balance of power on the ground, do you think?
Oh, it would definitely change the balance of the ground. And if we go back over the last couple of years, the fact that weapons have been flowing despite the fact that there was an arms embargo, weapons never stopped flowing into Libya from the UAE, from Egypt, etc. And that made a difference. But it's not just that, but also the training is going to be extremely important. Updating and upgrading Libya's air force, for example, the LNA's air force, the training new pilots or new technicians and engineers is definitely going to be a game changer for the LNA. And if Russia is able to do that, then it will definitely mean that the power dynamics will shift in Libya, and then the LNA will then stand a better chance of actually winning the war in Libya and taking over the country. But I still believe that Russia will not just violate the UN Security Council resolution just like that. And I think a lot has to change on the ground first. A lot of dynamics have to change, which will then make it inevitable that the positions within the international community, within the UN Security Council, will change as well. And the fact that Donald Trump will be in the White House in a couple of weeks is also going to change things at the UN Security Council and the United Nations at large.
Okay, Mohammed El-Jarr, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Leading Israeli officials have been encouraging soldiers and police officers to kill Palestinians suspected of attacks, regardless of whether lethal force is necessary. That is according to a new report by Human Rights Watch.
The organisation has compiled numerous statements by senior members of Benjamin Netanyahu's administration and the country's police force. The statements appear to endorse using lethal force against suspects, irrespective of whether anyone is in danger. Meanwhile, today has also seen a significant verdict in Israel's military courts. Liam O'Hare has more.
Well, the findings were announced as Israeli soldier Elor Azaria was today convicted of manslaughter after shooting an unarmed Palestinian man, Abdel Fattah al-Sharif. The incident took place in Hebron in the occupied West Bank last March after another soldier was stabbed. Azaria is the first Israeli soldier in 12 years to be convicted of actions while in uniform. Well, earlier I was joined by Sari Bashi, the Israel-Palestine Director at Human Rights Watch. I asked her to tell us more about the organisation's findings.
Sure. On Monday, we released a report analysing statements by senior Israeli officials encouraging police and soldiers to shoot to kill or in some cases failing to repudiate that kind of policy. Those statements are in violation of Israel's own rules of engagement and certainly of international standards, which allow lethal force only to be used when strictly necessary to protect life.
And obviously today, the Israeli soldier Eloy Azaria was convicted of manslaughter of the Palestinian man Abdel Fattah al-Sharif in Hebron last March. This is the first time in 12 years that an Israeli soldier has been convicted for actions while in uniform. Is this to be welcomed and seen as a sign of progress?
Well, it's not the first time that an Israeli soldier has been convicted, but it is the first time in a long time that he's been convicted of manslaughter for killing a Palestinian. And yes, it's a very welcome decision. It's a positive step toward reinforcing the rule of law and requiring soldiers and police officers to rein in the use of force. Azaria was videotaped by a volunteer for the human rights group B'Tselem shooting Abdel al-Sharif from close range. Al-Sharif had participated in a stabbing attack against another Israeli soldier, but that was many, many minutes before he was shot. And at the time, he was injured, lying on the ground, posing no threat to anybody.
Is there many more cases like al-Sharif that perhaps haven't been documented or at least haven't definitely made it to a courtroom situation, as in the case today?
So a really important distinction for the Azaria case is that the entire incident was videotaped, and that videotape went viral, making it very difficult for the Israeli military justice system to ignore it. Human Rights Watch has documented more than 150 cases since October 2015 in which Israeli security officials have fatally shot Palestinians that they suspect of carrying out attacks. Now, in at least some of those cases, there are very strong concerns about excessive use of force or even extrajudicial execution. So today's verdict is a positive step, but the Israeli military and Israeli police need to use it to clarify in no uncertain terms that there are very, very strict restrictions on the use of lethal force by security officials.
And if Israel does not take the initiative on this, on acting with verdicts like we've seen today, on bringing soldiers to trial when they do shoot to kill, is there a possibility that Israel could be held accountable in an international court of law, or is that something that is very much a distant prospect?
It's very distant. In Israel, as in most parts of the world, the prospect of international justice exists, especially because the Palestinians have ratified the International Criminal Court's treaty. There's a preliminary examination going on into the situation in Palestine, but the reality is that at least for the foreseeable future, the best bet for justice is the Israeli domestic system and international pressure on Israel to use its domestic justice system to enforce the law.
And just lastly, Sari, obviously in the past year we've seen an escalation in terms of violence. I think we've seen more Palestinians killed in the past year in the West Bank than in previous years before that. Do you think this might continue, and do you expect your organisation to have to continue to document cases like this in the year to come?
I'm sorry to say yes. For the last year and a half, there's been an escalation of violence, especially characterized by stabbing attacks against Israeli soldiers and civilians, and excessive use of force against Palestinian demonstrators and also Palestinian attackers. And the overwhelming problem is the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territory, which is entering its 50th year. So we can't ignore the fact that a military occupation conducted for so long under situations of such abuse is unfortunately going to continue to create work for human rights organizations.
Well, Sari Bashi, we very much appreciate you joining us today on World in Focus. Thanks so much for your time.
Take care. Goodbye.
The Venezuelan government has been facing accusations of economic mismanagement and anti-democratic activity since long before the embattled President Nicolas Maduro took office. His predecessor, Hugo Chavez, was repeatedly referenced by his detractors as a dictator, despite his sustained popularity in democratic elections. Indeed, Chavez's administration was subject to more than one coup attempt. For that reason, many have been quick to defend the Venezuelan government from its many critics on a number of issues. But one such issue which has dogged the Maduro administration ever since he took office in 2013 is that of political prisoners.
Human rights organisations such as Amnesty International have been highly critical of what they call unfair trials and imprisonment for political opponents of the government, and the incarceration of over 100 high-profile opposition figures has formed a cornerstone of the ethical case against Maduro's administration. Since cross-party dialogue opened up last year following an unprecedented intervention by the Vatican, a trickle of so-called political prisoners have been released. Most recently, this last week, the former presidential candidate Manuel Rosales, who was locked up back in October of 2015 on corruption charges, although his supporters have always considered his arrest to have been politically motivated.
Juan Nagel is a professor of economics at the University of Los Andes in Chile and a co-author of Blogging the Revolution, and he joins me on the line now from Santiago in Chile. Professor Nagel, thank you very much for coming on the programme today. Now, according to opponents of Maduro's administration, there are about 100 political prisoners still locked up. Given that, how significant are the handful of releases made so far in the context of Venezuela's somewhat fractious political divide?
Well, it certainly helps those that are promoting dialogue to make the case that dialogue is working and that it's yielding some fruits. Obviously, these people being free is obviously good news for them and for the political movement that they represent. The argument that's being made on the other side, the government has also put some people in jail. So in net, actually, the number of so-called political prisoners, as they claim, is actually going according to their calculations. So in that regard, yes, the liberation of political prisoners makes it more likely that there will be a dialogue between the opposing forces. However, the likelihood of that happening are still fairly low.
Will Maduro's opponents ever be satisfied with these releases? I mean, anything short of the release of every single individual on their list is surely not going to cut it.
I don't think so. I think there's some high-profile political prisoners that their liberation could cause a very significant shift in their position. Some of the more notable are the mayor of Caracas, who's in home imprisonment, or Leopoldo López even. It's unlikely that the government would yield with such high-profile prisoners, but what the opposition is looking for, real signs that the government is moving towards some conciliatory position by liberating these high-profile individuals.
Don't the releases, though, degrade the Maduro administration's position a little bit in terms of conceding their value as political prisoners? I mean, I wonder how the government is squaring the releases with the charges levelled against them. Manuel Rosales, who was one of those freed this week, wasn't arrested for opposing the government. Rather, he was arrested on corruption charges. I mean, is the government maintaining that those were the charges against him, even though his release is patently due to political and not judicial pressure?
I don't think the government made any statements about the release of the prisoners. I believe that, in fact, the people that were liberated in the last few days, they have to show up to court to sign every once in a while, and they are from leaving the country. So it's not like they've been granted complete freedom. And I think that what the government is basically saying is it's winking at the opposition, saying, look, I'm yielding on some aspects, and not really telling its people or making any public statements about the underlying facts of the cases that these people are involved in. As you say, Manuel Rosales is being charged with corruption. There are some of the other people that were liberated were clearly politically motivated, if you will. One of them was in a particularly harrowing case of the at an opposition democracy NGO that was raided by political forces. And this was a man that was simply the night watchman, and he was taken in without being involved at all in the day-to-day operations of the NGO that he was working for. So I think that there's a wide heterogeneity in the type of cases that were being targeted. It's not clear what the logic of the government was in freeing these particular seven individuals. I believe it was seven.
There are obviously a lot of question marks over a lot of these political prisoners. Opponents say that many of them aren't political prisoners. You referred before to Leopoldo López. He says he's a prisoner of conscience. His opponents say he instigated violent riots, which saw, I think it was 43 deaths. He can't be the only case where there are question marks over him. How cut and dried is the argument that these are all political prisoners?
Well, obviously it depends on who you ask. I believe that in the case of Leopoldo López, there have been numerous international NGOs and human rights organizations that have Amnesty International has been very particular in his case, as has been various Human Rights Watch and various other human rights organizations. Even Barack Obama himself has mentioned him as a prisoner of conscience. So what is a political prisoner? It'd be something that varies from opinion to opinion. I think that in the case of Leopoldo, the significant international support that his case has is part of the argument.
And just briefly before we finish, do you think 2017 we're going to see a lot more of these sorts of releases?
I would hope so. I mean, I think that the pressure is on the government. I think that the conditions on the ground in Venezuela are such that the government can ill afford to maintain many of these people in jail. Some of them have been imprisoned for tweeting against the government, and they've been in jail for two and a half years. So there's a lot of pressure on them to continue releasing them. I think that the hardening of position in the opposition is going to increase that pressure. So I would hope so.
Juan Nagel, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Jack.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, as Finland begins its nationwide trial of a universal basic income, two Scottish councils has announced their intentions to bring trials of their own. We'll be asking why the sudden surge in support for the centuries-old notion of a basic income for all. That's in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys.
When and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? If you're tired of a superficial and shallow reporting for the mainstream media, here's your alternative. Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from pundits who know so little about so much. We deal with real issues. War in the Middle East, the military-industrial complex, U.S.-Russian relations, the rise of China, austerity, mass migration, global warming, and social justice movements in the United States and around the world, and much more. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision makers take from the boardroom of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for chance speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com. Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, as Finland begins its nationwide trial of Universal Basic Income, or UBI, two Scottish councils have announced their intentions to begin trials of their own. We'll be speaking to a prominent campaigner for UBI, Guy Standing, about the sudden surge in support for the centuries-old notion of a basic income for all.
Two UN observers charged with overseeing the peace process in Colombia have landed themselves in trouble after New Year's Eve footage emerged of them dancing with an alleged female guerrilla fighters in one of the FARC rebel camps whose disengagement they've been watching over.
And when is the best time to stage a $6 million jewellery heist? Well, if you've been listening to the show since the start, you'll have probably heard me say it several times, and you'll know it's midnight on January the 1st, of course. But why? Well, find out at the end of the programme.
Behind idea of a universal basic income seems to be gaining some momentum around the globe. The notion itself that all citizens, regardless of employment or status, receive a basic monthly salary of sorts from the government is not a new one. It's a centuries-old theory which was supported by the likes of Thomas Moore, Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson, as well as some people not called Thomas, I'm assured.
This week, Finland begins a two-year trial of a universal basic income model, giving all unemployed people aged 25 to 58 a guaranteed monthly sum of €560, even if they have secure employment. The two-year study will monitor the impact that it has on employment levels and standard of living.
Two Scottish councils have this week said that they aim to trial a UBI model in the coming years, and similar trials are already underway around the globe. Earlier, I spoke with Guy Standing, Professor of Development Studies at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies and co-founder of the Basic Income Earth Network. I began by asking Guy if this rise in support for universal basic income was perhaps related to concerns over the rise of artificial intelligence and automated workforces.
Well, you're quite right that there is a surge of interest in basic income. And for your listeners, what it means is important to understand. It would mean that every person, every man, every woman and every child, probably with a child paid less, would receive a monthly amount, a basic amount, without conditions attached, which would help them have security and a sense of control of their lives. It's affordable, definitely, and our experiments have shown that if people had such a basic income, they would probably work more, not less, and it would improve mental health and reduce stress. Now, the reasons it's become suddenly very topical all around the world is that globalization and the sort of neoliberal economic policies that have been pursued for the last 30 years have produced incredible inequality. And the huge growth of the precariat, people in insecure positions with declining real wages and without a sense of occupation. And this chronic insecurity is feeding into political uneasiness, anger, voting for people like Donald Trump and for Brexit and for other unsavory characters in and across Europe. So you've got a combination of circumstances. And then, of course, as you've mentioned, the Silicon Revolution has given an image of approaching robots displacing workers in increased numbers and intensifying the insecurity and inequality. And the combination of circumstances is almost like a perfect storm, making people realize that we can't continue in the old way with the old form of welfare systems that were suited to another age and another type of society. And it's made basic income an attractive proposition. And in my books for over the last few years, I've been proposing it as one mechanism for redistribution, one mechanism for giving people security and for helping the precariat in particular. And it's suddenly become extremely popular to imagine testing it out in pilots in various countries. Finland is starting a pilot this month. Ontario in Canada is going to be launching a pilot during this year. And Scotland in various places, notably Fife and Glasgow, are considering the possibility of launching pilots. I very much hope that they can find the means and political support to be able to do that, because we can then see how it would work, to what extent it would have to be modified, what are the good sides and the bad sides of moving in that direction. And I think we're at a very interesting phase where people in politics are beginning to wake up to the need to confront these issues and think out of the box, as it were.
As you say, there could be trials happening in Scotland, and this is something which quite surprisingly and quite rarely happens. We've seen cross-party support for. We've had Conservative MSPs have tweeted approvingly towards these trials, and we've had a Labour councillor bringing it forward, and it's a policy that's supported by the SNP, who are in government, and by the Green Party. But I guess there is no one model for UBI, so could it be that once we agree that UBI might be something that we should trial. We'll see quite a lot of people debating over how you fund it. What model do we use to fund this? Could we see that break down into many different models itself once we agree on the trials?
Well, I think that's what you've said is absolutely correct. We could see a political opportunism being brought into the picture. It would be very, very surprising if that didn't take place. I think what we should do is be mature enough to say, look, all of us should believe in a better future. All of us should believe that our citizens should have basic security. And we need to think very positively about piloting this idea. The actual funding and the actual way the basic income would fit into a more general income distribution system would be a matter of debate. And that's the subject of my new book, because I'm saying that it could be a left policy, or it could be a right policy, or it could be a green policy, or a bit of each. And I think how it's politically developed is for the next 2 or 3 years. The important thing is to see what would happen to four ordinary people if they suddenly had a basic income and had a greater degree of control over their lives as a result. I think the results from our pilots in India, in Africa, in Canada, and psychological experiments are all showing that they have a very broad range of positive results for health, for nutrition, for mental health, for work, for a sense of security, for family relations, and for political attitudes. So that those positive results can be shown or questioned, if you like, by means of pilots. Whereas how it's funded, and it is funded by different ways, it can be funded by different ways, and how it would fit into a broader pattern of developing a new income distribution system suited to the 21st century, that's for another political debate, and of course we can have different views on that.
Well, Guy Standing, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Now, two United Nations employees acting as independent observers in Colombia have found themselves subject to scrutiny this week after video footage showed them apparently compromising their position as independent observers after they were caught on camera dancing with female members of a FARC jungle camp. Our very own Matthew Aiton has been trying to get his head around this one for us today, and he joins us in the studio now. Matthew, help us try and understand this. What actually happened here?
Well, as you said, this whole controversy stems from a short video clip that was originally shot by the Spanish news agency EFE of a fairly ordinary-looking New Year's Eve party. Of course, as you just mentioned, this particular party took place inside one of the many jungle camps in Colombia run by the FARC guerrillas, who, as listeners no doubt would be aware, are in the midst of a complex, historic and controversial peace process agreed with the Colombian government towards the end of last year. As a part of that deal, observers from the UN have been dispatched to watch over the FARC disarm and reintegrate into mainstream Colombian society. But a couple of those observers have gotten into a fair amount of trouble after footage from this party showed them, as you said, dancing with women from the FARC camp.
Obviously, Colombia is extremely divided with regards to the reintegration of the FARC into Colombian society. But, I mean, forgive me, but isn't this maybe a bit of an overreaction?
Well, that depends on your position, really. You have to remember that this conflict has claimed a great many lives over several decades, so it's not surprising that many would see any kind of engagement with the FARC rebels as being in poor taste. But the real dispute here is that these were UN observers, who are supposed to, of course, be independent, wearing UN insignia. As one conservative politician in Colombia said on Twitter, quote, "How can we trust the UN delegates in their impartiality when they go partying with the FARC?"
Is this just a storm in a teacup, though?
Well, no. Not according to the UN, who have taken this issue pretty seriously. They issued a statement on Monday night saying that they would be taking appropriate measures and that, quote, "this behaviour is inappropriate and doesn't reflect the values of professionalism and impartiality of the mission." So, whilst it's obviously tempting to warm to the original defence of this incident as representing nothing more than some innocent New Year's celebration, it's also important to remember why they're there, essentially. And that's to receive the weapons of the FARC and to watch them demobilise, as well as report back regularly on how both sides are adhering to the peace deal. So there's quite a lot at stake.
I must say, I saw this video just shortly before we went on air, and I was expecting something a little bit more kind of controversial and racier. It didn't seem that racy a video.
No, I mean, it looked a bit like an awkward first salsa lesson or something.
It's quite a conservative-looking New Year. Although I did think, after watching it, although it isn't particularly racy, we've all kind of done things at midnight at New Year that we've maybe lived to regret.
Yes. I don't think we need to know your stories there, Jack. But
anyway, that moves us on nicely.
Yes, and finally, when is the best time to steal $6 million worth of precious stones from a major Manhattan jewellery store? Well, probably it was the rest of the city, but mainly all of its police are counting in the New Year.
Yes, three New York burglars ushered in 2017 by committing a heist that yielded some $6 million worth of precious stones. The thieves broke into a jewellery store on West 36th Street at 1 minute past midnight on New Year's Day, wearing hooded sweatshirts, while a half mile away, 7,000 police officers were overseeing 2 million people enjoying the Times Square ball drop.
In what looks like an inside job, the three men entered the sixth floor store through a freight entrance, breaking in using a hammer and crowbar. Once inside, they made their way into the room containing four safes, which the burglars took earrings, necklaces and 18 karat gold bracelets.
Contain yourself, Karen. The men entered the building at around 10 p.m. but waited until midnight at Times Square before they snatched the trinkets. That is unfortunately all we have time for, and I'm not sure why we've all started laughing here. Carolyn just set us all off. I'm going to blame her.
That's fine.
Don't forget that you can listen to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.